Hello there, and welcome to another Strewn Along the Path episode here on the Journey Into podcast. My name is Marshall Latham, and I'm here to talk to you about movies that I've watched. One of these was a Netflix movie. The other two, I believe, were on Amazon Prime. So, our tradition for New Year's Eve has become a movie marathon. That's typically when I make my nachos, and we have, we typically have cheese crackers, beef log, that kind of thing for dinner, and what other treats are left over from Christmas and New Year's and whatever we can eat while we're watching the movies. And sometimes there's arguments and fights about which movies we're going to watch, what order we're going to watch them, and all that kind of thing. Sometimes we try to prepare for it the week ahead and say, okay, what do you guys want to watch? Because, you have six people, and parents don't necessarily want to watch everything the kids do, and kids don't necessarily want to watch everything the parents do, and the kids within themselves like this or that or the other and don't like the other person's pick and things like that. So sometimes, I remember a couple of years, it took us a long time just to pick a movie and then just decide which one we were going to watch next. This year, there was kind of a disagreement. Anyway, I guess let me tell you the movies that we ended up watching. It seems like there was a fourth movie that we watched. Because, we start watching around 5 o'clock or 6 o'clock and we go till midnight. And so, we usually end a little bit before midnight and then we watch the ball drop. Or actually, this year we watched the potato drop. In Boise, they have a big potato, giant potato that they put on a crane and they drop the potato. So that was kind of interesting to watch. But anyway, the three movies that I can remember that we watched were Incredibles 2. I hadn't seen it yet. I didn't see it in theaters. I think the kids had gone to see it by themselves because my older daughter can drive and wanted to take people out to the movie. So they all went, but my wife and I hadn't seen it. And so I was looking forward to seeing that because I'd heard great things. And I, liked the first Incredibles. So we watched Incredibles 2. And then we watched The Meg. A good popcorn movie, fun movie to watch on New Year's Eve. And then that's where the conflict came in. Because my wife was planning on watching Alpha. Because she had seen that on Amazon Prime, I think. So she was thinking we were going to watch Alpha. The rest of us were thinking we were going to watch Venom. My older son, it was a church dance, New Year's Eve dance kind of thing that he was thinking about going to. But then he stayed home because he wanted to watch Venom. I don't know. I think there was other reasons that he might not have wanted to go. But anyway, and so we were all thinking, okay, we're going to watch Venom. So there was a little bit of friction over watching Venom rather than Alpha. I don't know. I wasn't really in the mood, or I didn't care if I saw Alpha or not. Later on, I did end up watching it and probably include that in another episode somewhere down the line. So yeah, to my recollection, those are the three movies that we watched on New Year's Eve. So this is your New Year's Eve special. I don't know what that music means, but we'll just go with it. So I guess maybe I should start talking about the movies. What do you think? So Incredibles 2 delivered. It picks up right from where the first Incredibles movie stopped, against the Underminer. And I love the Underminer because, as everybody has compared Incredibles to the Fantastic Four, and as you know, I'm a big fan of the Fantastic Four. And so the Underminer represents essentially Mole Man. The Mole Man was the first villain that the Fantastic Four went against, back when they started in 1961. And so I thought it was really cool that the Underminer comes up from the underground. Of course, he didn't bring monsters with him. You know, Mole Man had a horde of monsters that followed him up to take over the surface world kind of thing. Underminer didn't have that, but just what he represented was the Mole Man, and I just loved that. So anyway, so it picks right up with the Underminer, and they start fighting the Underminer. And you'd think, you know, after everything that happened, you know, stopping the robot that Syndrome sent into the city in the first movie, that, you know, and they were cheered and congratulated. But then when the Underminer shows up and, you know, they go off to fight them, and, you know, there's damage to the city and people's lives are in danger or whatever. So it kind of goes back to, hey, we don't want these superheroes. They're dangerous kind of thing. So I was a little bit disappointed that they went back to the same status that they were in the first movie where you shouldn't be a superhero. But anyway, that didn't last too long. So that's fine. And so, you know, as you know from watching the first Incredibles movie, Bob, the dad character, you know, he was the one that went off and left his family to be the superhero on his own, doing secret missions or whatever. Ended up being for Syndrome. But, and so in this movie, they flop it, where Helen is the one that gets to go on the secret missions. And so what happens is there's a wealthy family that wants to support superheroes coming back. Their dad was a big fan of superheroes. You know, he had a hotline, a phone, you know, kind of like from the Adam West Batman, where the commissioner had a red phone, a hotline that would just call directly to Batman when he was in time of need. So their dad, this wealthy businessman, had hotlines directly to, was it Gazer Beam? And somebody else, another superhero. So he had two different hotline phones. The son had inherited the business or whatever. Maybe him and his sister both had. But so they wanted to be big proponents of supers being recognized and celebrated like they were back in the day to honor, you know, their dad. Their mom and dad had been killed in an attack, and when they called the supers, they never showed up, pretty much because Syndrome had killed them or whatever. So they were killed when their home was invaded. So they were going to put all this money forward, and I think the sister was like an inventor. You know, she invented all these technological breakthroughs. And so they chose Helen to be, Elastigirl, to be their choice as the first person that would go out. And they were going to record her, you know, kind of catching up with the times, like with the body cams that police wear and stuff like that. So they were going to capture all of her heroics on camera and present that to the public. And so Bob has to stay home with the kids. You know, we have Violet, who's like the invisible girl. She has force field powers and invisibility. And then Dash is a super speedster, kind of represents Human Torch, I guess, because he's young and impetuous. And then there's Jack-Jack, who has multiple powers and like a super baby kind of thing, as we found out in the first movie. So nobody in the family knows that Jack-Jack has powers, because that all happened when the family was fighting Syndrome and whatever. And they didn't really see what was going on up in the air when Syndrome was holding Jack-Jack. So anyway, that's a lot of fun with the kids back at home. You know, as a dad, he's struggling because, and I related a lot to that, you know, helping his kids with their homework. And of course, they want the kids to do math in a different way. And so you have to learn how they're learning. And so you can help them with their homework, not do their homework, but help them. And so he was fighting with that. Violet was having a hard time because, unbeknownst to everybody, the government guy had erased. So at the beginning of the movie, the boy that Violet had asked out on a date, that was going to go on a date, he was in the parking lot and he saw her change into her costume, or he saw her in her superhero costume. And so they had told the government guy about that, and so he erased the boy's memory. Well, he erased the boy's memory of Violet altogether. He didn't even know who she was. And so she was expecting to go out on this date, and the boy didn't show up. So she was all depressed and moody, and, you know, the dad didn't know how to deal with that. He was trying to help, but, you know, felt helpless. And I've definitely felt that way as a dad before. So, yeah, there was a lot of good family moments in there. A lot of things I could relate to. Like I said, Bob doesn't know that Jack-Jack has powers. And so how he finds that out is pretty cool. Jack-Jack has this battle with a raccoon in the backyard. And it's pretty comical. Pretty good stuff. But while all that stuff's going on at home, of course, Elastigirl is on her mission. So, you know, she's basically looking for something to do, somebody to save. And in another nearby city, which is more of a metropolis or Gotham or, you know, big city, New York type city. Oh, and the sister developed this really cool Elasticycle thing where it separates. And so Helen can use her elasticity or whatever to do incredible things with the bike, like have the back wheel going this way and the front wheel going this way. And they did a really good job on her powers throughout this whole thing. You know, the stuff they do with the Incredibles, you wish they would have done more of this kind of stuff with the Fantastic Four movies. But alas, we have not seen that yet. Anyway, so she's on her first mission. She's on her Elasticycle, and there's a train, like a new super fast train that's being set up. Well, it gets taken over and it starts going backwards. And of course they haven't got the entire rail system finished yet. So people are going to die. And so she's chasing the train on her Elasticycle and eventually, you know, saves everything. But again, it's done really cool, really fun. Watching those action scenes with her, and, you know, more fun, I think, than in the first movie where Mr. Incredible is on his mission. I mean, that was fun too, but there's so much more you can do with Elastigirl. And so that was a lot of fun to watch. And then she kind of has this person that the person that took over the train was it the Screen Slaver? And, you know, so it's using technology to take over people, you know, people that are watching screens get hypnotized to either sit there and do nothing or to do what the Screen Slaver wants. And there's a part later on in the movie where he's kind of giving his manifesto of, you know, why he's doing this. You know, it's everybody's enslaved to their screens and to technology and aren't experiencing things for themselves. And actually in listening to that, I was like, you know, that describes our society perfectly, myself included. You know, we get so caught up in technology, our phones, our TV, our streaming, all that stuff, that we do kind of lose track of everything else that's more important. Not that we can't enjoy those things, but I think as a society, and me as well, rely on our technology too much. So, but I say that as I'm recording a podcast on a recorder that I'll use my computer for and all that kind of stuff. But anyway, but it turns out that Screen Slaver was kind of a front and the real villain is kind of hiding behind the scenes. So I guess, you know, if I have a complaint or a disappointment in this movie, comparing it to the first one, it's that the villain doesn't really match up to Syndrome was an awesome villain. They set him up early in the beginning and then we weren't expecting who it was, but it made so much sense. And the character was portrayed and written so well, directed, I guess, in animation, so well that it really was an effective villain, a good villain that we could relate to, as well as, you know, we didn't like him very much because he was so annoying. But he was funny, too, where the villain in this one, I'm not going to spoil that part of it, but in all honesty, it's kind of obvious from the beginning, at least for me. And like I said, my kids had seen it at the theater, but my wife and I hadn't. But both my wife and I said, yeah, it was pretty obvious who the villain was going to be. And I asked my kids about it, and they said, yeah, when they saw the movie, they had kind of figured it out pretty quick, too, who the real villain was. But yeah, this guy that's trying to promote the supers, you know, he wants to have this summit where many leaders of the world sign a, I don't know what you call it, an agreement or a treaty or whatever, that they will develop and let supers work in their countries, and that's what they're all trying to do. And of course, the villain behind it doesn't want that to happen. And so they go out on this boat to sign this treaty. And along the way, Helen meets other superheroes from other nations. And, you know, we kind of get introduced to them and their powers a little bit. And one in particular is kind of a fangirl of Elastigirl. And so that's kind of cool to have that kind of interaction. I think Holly Hunter does a really good job with that. I like her voice for that character because she can be kind of the sweet, loving, supporting wife. But she can also be, you know, sassy and sarcastic and you know, kind of snarky to the villains or whoever she's talking to, you know, if she's upset. And so I really like that characterization. The voice is perfect for that. I'll have to look. I was wondering about the kids, and I was talking to my wife about that. Did they get the same voice actors to play the kids? Were they kids in the first place for the first movie, or is it adults that played kids so they could repeat that voice performance? I'll have to look that up, I guess. Maybe put it in the show notes, or if I get interrupted in recording this part, I can always go back and put this in. So you might never hear what I'm talking about right now. Isn't that strange? Isn't that weird? Yeah, so I thought the characters were really good. I liked the action. I liked the comedy. It's a really good movie. Of course, by the end, the whole family gets pulled in again, and Frozone is there as well as part of it. And it's all done really well. It took 14 years between the first Incredibles and this sequel. And a lot of that's because they wanted to get the story right. They didn't want to just do a sequel to do a sequel. It had to be the right thing. Brad Bird, who's the director and the writer of it, wanted to have the right thing. Wanted it to work well. And it does. You know, I really like the setting, how it's like kind of 60s, but kind of unplaceable. You know, there's elements from the 60s and elements from, I guess, mostly 60s, 70s, but yet it's not done as like a period piece. You know, it's just, but the cars are older and the architecture of everything is kind of got that feel of a Bond era, early Bond era kind of stuff. So I like that aesthetic of it, but it's timeless as well. They never put a time marker on there or whatever. And so it could be anything. Oh, and the Elastigirl is back and used really well. Because in the first movie, you know, it was just kind of there. No, what did I say? Incredible car? What is it? Incredible? Maybe that's what it's called. Anyway, that I thought was really cool, the way that was done. And, you know, Dash and Violet and everybody, I mean, it just all works out really well. So I recommend Incredibles 2. It's a great movie. You know, I complained about the villain not being as good, but that doesn't mean that I didn't like the movie. That doesn't mean that it wasn't worth watching and that it wasn't a good sequel. It just meant I didn't like the villain as much. It was kind of obvious who the villain was. But it was great to see the movie. You know, who knows if they'll do a third one, and it might not matter if they do. I mean, it's kind of a timeless thing. I think they could do. Oh, yeah, and Edna Moon. Is it Edna Moon? Is in there again, and she's great. I love that. I think Brad Bird voices her, right? Am I remembering that correctly? But, yeah, she's great in it again. Just a small little part. So, yeah. Anyway, should probably move on to the other movies that we watched on New Year's. The second movie we watched was The Meg. And, you know, I knew what I was getting with the Meg. You know, this giant shark. My son's kind of watched a lot of shark movies. You know, he was the one that wanted to watch Jaws for a long time and finally let him watch Jaws. And he liked it, and he's watched all the Jaws movies. But he always laughs, and it makes me so mad. He laughs at the part where at the beginning, the first scene in Jaws where the drunk girl goes out into the bay and swimming out by the buoy.
The buoy?
The buoy. And the shark comes up with the music, you know, and then she's being drugged back and forth and screaming and yelling. He's like, oh, it's so fake. And I'm like, no, it's not. That's one of the most compelling scenes of all time. You know, I wouldn't, that's not a fake thing. And, you know, but maybe to his eyes it is, you know. So that always makes me mad when we talk about Jaws and he laughs at that. But speaking about laughing, I laughed at several parts of this movie, The Meg. And I guess maybe it's just because I wasn't taking it too seriously and I knew what kind of a movie it was and just, you know, was kind of in the mood to enjoy it for what it was. But there's this... okay, so it starts off, you know, they're on this rig out in the middle of the ocean and they're doing research. They're going down lower than anybody's ever gone before, below this frozen layer of the ocean, deeper than they've ever explored before, and they're, you know, they want to explore exotic animals and learn about the sea and probably, you know, if there's anything that can be used for the benefit of man or whatever kind of thing. And so they're on this facility and it's under, a lot of it is underwater. And when they go down, there's, you know, they're seeing life that they've never seen before, but then they're also attacked by this unknown thing. Of course, we know it's the Meg. Basically, that frozen layer, that cold layer of the ocean has always protected the sea from the Meg. You know, they've been kept down there by that layer. Well, so these people are stuck down there. Hero is one of them. Hero from, what was it? From Heroes? The Heroes TV show? Was one of the guys that was stuck down there. So they have to go get... Or no, I guess it starts off before all that. Where, so Jason Statham is the big star of this show, and he is somebody that will do deep sea rescues. Like if somebody's in trouble in the deep sea, he'll go rescue. So we actually start this with a deep sea rescue where he saves people, but he fails. They're attacked by something and he doesn't get everybody out. He abandons, I think, two people down there. And every since then, he's never done it again. He's escaped that life. He won't go down and do that anymore. But they know he's the best. His ex-wife is one of the people that's down that needs to be saved. And so they go after him to get him to come rescue the submarine. So they talk him into it. He comes and he saves them, or as many as can be. Hero sacrifices himself. Sorry for the spoilers. But yeah, so he rescues everybody. And there's another, there's a Asian woman that is also part of the team, and she goes down and tries to rescue them before he gets there. And she has a little daughter that's on the station with them. And there's the scene that you've seen from the trailer, where, you know, she's in this big undersea tube, you know, because a lot of the hallways are transparent where you can see the sea around you. And you see this humongous giant shark, the Meg, show up. So basically, by them going down there and rescuing the people and coming up out of the frozen layer or the cold layer allows an escape for the Meg. So the Meg is able to escape that layer. Now he's above there. Or she, I guess it could be, and is able to take on the inhabitants of the sea world and whatever, coastal shores and all that kind of stuff. And so, yeah, they realize they're dealing with a Meg. I just love, it's the Meg. I used to say that all the time. We're going to watch the Meg. And so, if I say that a lot, that's because I enjoy it. And they're looking for ways to kill it and to track it and to, you know, they know that they can't just leave it out there or it'll kill people and kill other animals and all that kind of stuff. And so So there's, of course, a lot of action scenes, a lot of fighting with the Meg and things like that. But anyway, one of the first scenes after the, you know, tries to bite the through the tube to get to the girl, and she's freaking out, and they're like, oh my goodness. They were watching these two whales, the two humpback whales. There was, I can't remember the names for the whales, but there was a mom and her calf that were down there. And there was this scene where you see the baby calf is coming up to them and kind of crying, you know, with through whale song and everything. And they're like, oh, what's the matter? Where's your mother? And then the Meg shows up and eats the little calf, eats the whale calf. And for some reason, just the way that scene was shot, you know, you knew something, I knew something was coming. And so when it did, I just started laughing. And my family's looking at me like, what are you laughing for? And I don't know. It's just funny because I can't explain it really. It just made me laugh. Not that I want to see a baby whale eaten in front of me, but just the way the scene is shot, and you know, here you got this giant shark eating the calf and shocks everybody and surprises everybody. It just hit me. And I kind of laughed. I said, it's not that I don't like the movie. It's not that I'm mocking it. It's just, I don't know. I found it entertaining that they would do that. I don't know. And then there was another spot where Jason Statham is in the water and the Meg is coming after him. And there was something preventing the Meg from killing him. But eventually the Meg gets free and then he's trying to get to the boat. And he jumps onto the boat just as the Meg comes out of the water to eat him. And it's a near miss. And just, I don't know, that made me laugh too. So I started laughing at that part. And they're like, still looking at me like, what are you doing? Why are you laughing? And I just, I don't know what it was. I thought it was a fun movie to watch. I enjoyed all of it. I didn't never took it seriously for 1 minute. And I don't think we were meant to. I don't know. I mean, Jaws is a pretty serious movie and it's got a lot of those elements in it, but it, I don't know. It's just become such a trope and such a thing that we expect now. You can never do a movie like Jaws again. The genie is out of the bottle, as they say, for that kind of a movie. But I mean, it's got a lot of very serious elements to it as you're watching Jaws. You know, a lot of it is drama. A lot of it is boring to a younger person. Because, you know, it's just looking at Brody and he's drinking and he's talking to the mayor and they're doing all this, you know, stuff. And until you get on the boat, there's not a lot of action. Well, I guess there was when the kid got eaten on the beach and stuff. Here I go laughing again at somebody getting killed by a shark. But anyway, I mean, nobody was ever meant to take the Meg seriously like they did Jaws. Jaws was the, you know, the book and the movie were meant to be kind of a serious, what if there was this really big shark out there and how would you kill it and what would happen? And the 70s were different, of course. So movies were different back then. It wasn't all about the spectacular special effects and all about the action and the quips and all that kind of stuff. That movies were more serious back then anyway, but you're never going to make a Jaws again. And, you know, the Meg was made to be a entertaining popcorn movie that, so I didn't take it seriously. And so just some of those scenes just kind of made me laugh because, you know, I was never on the edge of my seat wondering what was going to happen. And, oh, what if I was in that situation? It was just, but I enjoyed it. I thought it was a lot of fun. You just couldn't take anything seriously. You know, there was the Rainn Wilson was there as kind of the millionaire behind this big project. And he was stupid and did a lot of stupid stuff and was kind of slimy about everything. And so he played his part in there. He gets his comeuppance, I guess you could say. So yeah, if you just want a fun popcorn movie to enjoy and have fun, just I recommend The Meg. If you're looking for a serious movie, you'd look for something else. Like The Shallows that I reviewed a while back. That was an interesting shark movie. With kind of a realistic premise and how is this girl going to survive. That was more serious and more, I was more into that, what was going to happen. And oh my goodness, because I was more invested in her as a character, I guess, and more invested in the situation that she was in because it seemed realistic. My son and my wife, I think they were the only two that watched, what is it, 27 Fathoms Down or something like that, which is also about sharks that are attacking and people getting killed and what are they going to do. You know, and I guess I could have done this movie along with Jurassic World, Fallen Kingdom, because I have seen that movie, and I'll review that one. It's a similar type thing. Instead of a prehistoric shark in the ocean, you have these prehistoric engineered dinosaurs attacking. And why is that more successful than something like the Meg? You know, I'll talk more about that, I guess, when I talk about Jurassic World, Fallen Kingdom. But it's the same type of movie. But even Fallen Kingdom, I think, is more serious, even in this most recent, you know, what is it, that this is the fifth movie now of Jurassic Park. And so even that's a little bit more serious, and I get into it more of the characters and their plight and that kind of thing than I did for the Meg. I just didn't take it that seriously, I guess. But it's fun. I liked it. I enjoyed it. So the last movie we watched on New Year's, seems like we watched more than three movies. Anyway, so the last movie that we watched was Venom, because I hadn't seen that in the theaters either, but I'd heard that it was good, better than people expected it to be, and that it was kind of different and offbeat and that kind of thing. So I thought, well, yeah, and the kids wanted to see it. Like I said, the only reason my son, well, he says the only reason he stayed home from the dance on New Year's Eve was because he wanted to watch Venom. But we watched Venom. And yeah, it was pretty good. You know, again, for not expecting too much, it was surprisingly good. I can see where they could have gone the R-rated route, you know, because that was one of the big things when the movie came out. Is it going to be R or is it going to be PG-13? And they kind of talked about it being a PG-13 movie. And some people were upset about that. But I thought they did a pretty good job. Eddie Brock, you know, as a hero character, is he an anti-hero similar to... He's definitely not the Eddie Brock from the comic books, because Eddie Brock was kind of a douchebag, as they say. Not a very nice guy, but eventually ended up being okay. Where this Eddie Brock in the movie is just pretty much, he's not a bad guy. He's not out to hurt anybody, but he's also out for the story and kind of out for himself and doesn't commit to a lot of things like his relationship. So, you know, taking all of the comic book stuff out, I mean, in the comic books, Venom, during Secret Wars, Spider-Man needed a new costume and they had this machine that made new costumes, but somehow this symbiote, this alien life, and nobody knew it at the time. I wonder if it was even planned for during the Secret Wars crossover. But so Spider-Man had a new black Spider-Man suit. He modeled it off of Spider-Woman's suit, who was, and you know, I know there's a whole story of different Spider-Women that really have, through the years, have had nothing to do with Spider-Man himself, which I think is interesting. But a side thought. But anyway, there was a Spider-Woman, I think the third version of Spider-Woman, who used psychic abilities rather than web-slinging or anything like that. There's never been a Spider-Woman who's been a web-slinger, unless you get into the whole Spider-Verse thing, which opens up a whole other can of worms. And I'm sure I'll talk about that movie at some point after I see it, which I haven't seen at this point. So anyway, Spider-Man got a new costume up in space during the on Battle World during Secret Wars, big mega crossover event. He comes back, well, and the way they did that in the comic books is there was, in the individual comic books, so an Amazing Spider-Man, it led him up to where he got teleported or whatever into Battle World, where the whole Secret Wars took place. And then the next issue of the comic was after he came back from Secret Wars, and he came back with the black costume. So it was a 12 issue miniseries of Secret Wars. So for a whole year, there's this limited series going on of Secret Wars. And in it, you figure out
where Spider-Man got his black costume from, which was kind of a cool idea, I thought. And they did that across the line, right? Fantastic Four left for Battle World with Ben Grimm and came back with She-Hulk as a member of the Fantastic Four. Well, how the heck did that happen on Battle World? And so that was kind of a cool thing that they did. They don't do that anymore, right? They spread it across for ages and ages, and it goes across the whole comic line at once. But I thought that was kind of cool what they did with Secret Wars. That's all a long way of saying, in the comic books, Spider-Man got his black costume in space, came back to Earth, used the black costume. It had a lot of cool features, automatically did things that he wanted, came on and off. He didn't realize that it was an alien life form. And we came to find out that it was a symbiote, and it was basically bonding with Spider-Man and becoming a part of him. That's kind of what this life form does. And then eventually it started to control him, and he couldn't get rid of it, and it wouldn't go away. And he had to go up on this bell tower, and because it was, as we learn in the movie Venom as well, they're very susceptible to sonic noise. So, you know, anything very loud or very, you know, sonic vibrations kind of thing, like an MRI, adversely affects these creatures. It freaks them out. They don't like it. Eventually, they could die. So Spider-Man, Peter Parker, goes up to this bell tower and stands right next to the bell when it's ringing. Of course, I've never had that experience, but I'm sure it's very, very loud. And so the suit peels off of him. It was a big deal in the Spider-Man comics, this whole black suit symbiote. And it has been ever since, right? That's why Venom is a popular character. And there's been other symbiotes and all this kind of stuff. And I'm sure I'm getting some of the specifics wrong. Spider-Man heads would probably say, oh, you're getting it wrong. But anyway, he's finally able to get the costume off of him, and it drips down through the bell tower down into a church. And Eddie Brock in the comic books was a competing photographer for the Daily Bugle. But he didn't have any scruples. He just, you know, did what he wanted and was in competition with Peter Parker. Well, Peter Parker exposed him for a photograph that he had doctored up and wasn't real. And he lost his job and lost his reputation. Nobody would hire him anymore. So he hated Peter Parker. And he was in the church talking about how much he hated Peter Parker. And this was in the comics. I'm not just getting it all from Spider-Man 3, the original Sam Raimi. They tried to be somewhat dutiful to the comics in that one. And I don't even think about that. That's weird. The whole time I've been thinking about Venom, I never was thinking about Spider-Man 3 until right now. That's kind of weird. But kind of cool, because the comics version was really awesome. And that's what I'm talking about. So Eddie Brock, so this symbiote, Venom, comes down and bonds now with Eddie Brock. And Eddie Brock hates Peter Parker. And obviously the symbiote feels betrayed by Peter Parker. And so now this Venom character, Eddie Brock, becomes a villain, becomes a nemesis to Spider-Man, a villain against Spider-Man kind of thing. So, and then there's a whole history of Venom after that. But that's the origin of Venom in the comic books. And so to take all of that out of this movie, because everybody kept saying, you know, how are they going to do that? Spider-Man's not involved. You know, yes, it's a Sony product. It's a Spider-Man character. They own the rights. But how are they going to do that without having Tom Holland involved in that, you know, as Spider-Man, and building that as a spinoff of the Spider-Man movies? And doing that naturally. So they totally divorced it from Spider-Man at all. I thought it was a pretty reasonable explanation of how the symbiotes got to Earth. You know, they just had to create an evil corporation that was trying to do something evil. And finding, they found life out in the universe, or out in space, and wanted to bring it back and control it. That kind of, so you had the evil. I guess he was supposed to be like an Elon Musk, but an evil Elon Musk kind of guy that ran this company. And of course, Eddie Brock tried to expose him for all the shady things that he'd been dealing with. And his girlfriend got fired because of it, because she worked for the company indirectly. And, you know, he just couldn't do an interview, a normal interview. He had to do an expose. He had to ask difficult questions. And it led to his career especially being down the tubes, wasn't able to do anything. One of the scientists that worked for this evil company, I'll just call it Evil Company Inc. because I can't remember the name of who worked for this company or whatever. But she called Eddie and said, hey, you were right. There's bad things going on here. Because essentially, they had brought the spacecraft or whatever that was bringing the samples back of these symbiotes down from space, their space station, and the vehicle got destroyed. Everybody was killed. But they were able to get these symbiotes. And so they start doing experiments trying to bond humans with the symbiotes, and it's killing people, right? They don't, they're it takes a special person or somebody with the right, I don't know, characteristics to bond with these symbiotes. And there's several of them down there. So anyway, this scientist just doesn't like what's going on anymore. So she calls Eddie Brock and says, you know what? You're right. I can get you in. I can give you proof. You can expose what's going on here, and hopefully it'll stop. And so she sneaks him in to this evil corporation, Evil Incorporated. And Eddie Brock eventually, yeah, oh, because they're taking homeless people off the street, and he knows several homeless people. He sees somebody that he knows in there from the street and tries to save her, ends up exposing himself and getting bonding with this symbiote, but he doesn't really know what's going on. And then he has to escape, and basically the alien being takes over and helps him, saves him to get out of there. And so he's on the run and gets back to his apartment, and he's eating a bunch of stuff, and he doesn't know what's going on. And so, but this is how it happens in the movie. And if I wasn't a comic book fan, I didn't know anything about the Spider-Man connection or anything else, it kind of works as this one-off. Something totally devoid of Spider-Man or superheroes or anything. We have this Venom character bonded with Eddie Brock. And we like Eddie Brock. He's not the smartest guy. He does a lot of stupid things. But he's not a bad guy. So we kind of like him. But... you know, it is violent. This thing eats people. It kills people. It has no problems doing that. And so, you know, Eddie kind of has to go along for the ride. They're bonded. Eventually, the evil boss bonds with another one of these aliens. And they have, basically, the way the movie explains it is that they take over entire civilizations and take over their worlds, because they need other alien beings, you know, humans or somebody like a human on another planet to bond with so that they can have power. By themselves, they aren't. So eventually it's Eddie Brock / Venom versus Evil Corporation guy / there was a name for the other symbiote. I thought that was interesting. Is that the way it is in the comics, that Venom is the surname of the symbiote? Or was Venom just the melding of the two? So I think that was new to that they talked about in the movie, that Venom was the actual name of the symbiote. And then I want to say Rerun. Was Rerun the name? I don't think it was, but I'm going to call him Rerun. So there's Venom versus Rerun. And Rerun was basically, he was the leader, or he's a stronger symbiote. And of course, he's with the evil guy. So that's a good fit, right? That they're evil, the evil leader of the corporation bonds with the evil symbiote. And so they're going to send this thing up into space to get more symbiotes to come down and take over people from the Earth. And so you have Eddie. And this, and then his ex-girlfriend gets involved. And that was kind of a cool part, too, is that, you know, at first, after she loses her job and everything, she breaks it off with Eddie Brock and pretty much cuts all ties with him, and he's trying to, he still loves her, has feelings for her, wants to get her back, but she pretty much cuts him off all the time. But she get, you know, he finds her, and she's got another boyfriend, and the boyfriend doesn't mind helping him either. He's a really nice guy, and even though this is her ex-boyfriend that they're helping, he's a scientist and wants to help. He's kind of intrigued by this parasite thing, symbiote, and so he's doing tests on Eddie to help him out and help him feel better, and they're finding out things about it. And so she's still kind of helping Eddie or whatever. And there was a really cool part where Eddie gets separated from the symbiote and is on the run, and they get him. The corporation collects him and bring him back, but he doesn't have the symbiote, and so then the evil guy is upset. This is before he bonds with a symbiote. I'm just going to keep saying symbiote until you can't stand it anymore. Symbiote, 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 symbiote. That's what they call him. Where was I going with that? Oh, yeah. So the girlfriend, ex-girlfriend, whatever you want to call her, realizes that... Oh, and so the symbiote has gone from different people, has gone in and taken over, possessed other people's bodies, trying to get back to Eddie. And eventually goes into this little dog. Is it a Pomeranian? It's not a Chihuahua. I think it's a little Pomeranian dog. And Venom is... But eventually, you know, the dog's going to die, or he needs to find a new... Venom needs to find a new host. And so the girlfriend realizes that Venom, the symbiote, is in the dog. And so she... you don't see it. It doesn't happen on screen. But basically she agrees to let the symbiote take her over so she can get him back to Eddie Brock. Eddie Brock's going to be killed in the woods. He escapes. He's running. And she finds him. And she defends, or, you know, kills all the people that are trying to get Eddie, because now she has Venom. And it's a female Venom. It's got the curves. It's got the look, you know. And so she fully venomizes out, but she's a female Venom, which was kind of cool. I had never seen that before. Maybe they've done that in the comics or whatever, but I thought that was pretty cool. But of course, as soon as she gets to Eddie, Venom goes from her into him. And that was kind of cool. I had never seen that before. A sexy Venom. That was kind of cool. And so anyway, so... Like I was started to say before I went back and gave some more of the backstory, Eddie Brock goes up against Evil Dude and Rerun. they're on the spaceship or on the platform or whatever, trying to stop this thing from going out into space and bringing back more symbiotes. Symbiote, symbiote, symbiote. And they have this all-out battle. And it looks like everybody... gets killed, all the symbiotes, except Eddie survives. But it appears that Venom is gone, that he's been killed. And so the story kind of ends with he goes and he talks to his old girlfriend. Maybe she's becoming his girlfriend again, who knows. And he just talks to her, and, you know, she says, "You're all right? Everything okay now that the symbiote's gone?" He's like, "Yeah, it's fine." And then you realize that, because throughout the movie, and part of the humor of it is Eddie and Venom talking to each other through in his mind. You hear what Venom says in his mind, and then Eddie responds, and they're kind of going back and forth about it. You got to stop eating people. You can't eat people. And so not only is the stuff from Venom rubbing off on Eddie Brock, the goodness, the innate, you know, humanity goodness of Eddie Brock is rubbing off onto Venom. And so now he's by the end of this movie, he's become this anti-hero type character of him and Venom put together. So that was kind of cool. But yeah, like I was saying, the kids really liked the movie. You know, we watched it. Well, of course we watched it all together. And, you know, there was a lot of lines where they laughed, and because a lot of it was, you know, Venom's lines were pretty funny when he was talking to Eddie Brock or saying, now we're going to do this or whatever was going on. So there was a lot of humor in that. And the kids laughed a lot at that. And anyway, it was a good movie. It was a lot better than it should have been. I was never excited to go see it. I didn't think it was going to be a total train wreck. A lot of people did. I thought Sony did a pretty good job with it. They did something different. It was something different we hadn't seen before in a comic book movie. Eddie Brock was a different kind of a character than we've seen. You know, he wasn't a Tony Stark or a Stephen Strange or a Peter Parker. I mean, he was really different. Tom Hardy is kind of a weird dude. I realize, you know, I remember him from, you know, Dark Knight Rises and Inception. He was Mad Max too, right? In the latest Mad Max movie, which I haven't seen. You know, so I've kind of known him from those types of roles. I've never really known him, what his personality was. But yeah, he's kind of a, I don't know if it was just him being Eddie Brock, you know, this is what the character needed to be, or whether this is kind of his acting style when he's a lead actor and not a supporting character. But he was interesting. He was different. It wasn't the typical type of superhero movie. So I enjoyed it. I'm glad we watched Venom instead of Alpha. However, I ended up, spoilers for the future, I did end up liking Alpha better than I thought I would. But I'm glad we watched Venom instead on New Year's Eve. Oh! Okay, so let me finish up Venom. So Venom, I recommend Venom. It's a pretty fun movie, and they set up Carnage at the end. Carnage in the comic books is another symbiote that is even worse than Venom ever thought about being. He's a full-out sociopathic killer. Anyway, but they set that up in the end credits where it's not Tom Cassidy. He's got a alliterative name. Anyway, I never actually read much Carnage stuff, but I know who Carnage is. So it's pretty much another symbiote that's worse than Venom paired with a serial killer, right? Sociopathic character. And so they wreak carnage. And Spider-Man has fought Carnage over the years. And, of course, the whole symbiote thing has been expanded. And, you know, there's lots of different things. Maybe that's where a rerun came from. So they set that up, too. So there could be a sequel for Venom. Maybe it'll be called Venom:Carnage or something like that. But it was kind of cool because, what's his name? Because Woody Harrelson played the part of, I want to say Tom Cassidy, but I know that's not right. I think it's Cassidy, but I don't think Tom was his first name. So that'll be interesting if they do another one of those. I don't know if it'll be PG-13 or R, but anyway, that's all I know about that. So, I just remembered. We also watched, and this is the TV reference, but on Amazon Prime, I've been watching over the years, the Doctor Who series. And so I know that Peter Capaldi ended his run as Doctor Who. Can't think of the actress's name, but she was on, I know we're from Broadchurch, which was a BBC series. And so now there's a woman doctor, and she's already started her own series on the BBC network, but I don't get the BBC or BBC America or anything like that. So anyway, so I was watching, it's been a while since I got back to finishing off the last season of Peter Capaldi's Doctor. So I finally got to the end of that series, and he didn't transform and then change into the woman doctor. He almost was, and they don't call it transforming, transitioning, no. No, I don't know what they call it, but anyway. But he's fighting it off, and he goes to Antarctica or something like that. And then at the very end of the episode, he meets up with the original Doctor Who, the original Doctor. You know all that stuff. And if you don't, just start watching Doctor Who, you'll understand. His name isn't Doctor Who, he's just called the Doctor. And so anyway, the very original Doctor from back in you know, when it first started back in the 1960s. Of course, that actor is dead now, but they really did a good job of bringing that actor back. And so it was a team up of the original Doctor plus Peter Capaldi Doctor. And they had an adventure together. And I'm not going to talk, I've talked way too long. This episode's gone on for quite a while. So I'm not going to go into details, but it was the basically what they call the Christmas special. Every year, Doctor Who has a Christmas special. That was this one. And it was in the Christmas special, not the end of the series, where the Doctor at the end transformed into the new Doctor, who at this time is a woman. And so they pretty much have gotten rid of all. And this was Stephen Moffat. His last season or series of kind of writing for and being the showrunner for Doctor Who. So it's got a whole new crew. So all of the old companions of the Doctor, everything, it's kind of a reset. So now with the new Doctor as a woman, she's going to have, you know, a whole new, it's kind of like between David Tennant and Matt Smith. They totally did a reset on all of that. All of the previous companions and storylines and stuff from the David Tennant Doctor Who got erased, and they started a whole new thing with Matt Smith as the Doctor, and that's where Amy Pond came in and that whole thing, and so that kind of created his own world. And so now I have to wait for a while until I get to see the new adventures of Doctor Who, of the Doctor in Doctor Who. And so there you have it. That's my New Year's Eve special edition of the Netflix queue. However, I think only The Incredibles was a Netflix movie. The other two we got off of Amazon Prime. And then, as I talked about, the Doctor Who Christmas special was also from Amazon Prime. So that's what we watched this New Year's Eve. I'll come back next year and talk about what we watched 2019 New Year's Eve. So look forward to that. And in the meantime, we'll find out what else is strewn along the path. See you later.
The Journey Into podcast is produced under Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivatives License, which means that you can share it as much as you would like, but please don't change it or sell it, and let people know where you got it from, here on the Journey Into podcast.
So anyway, there's a lot of good action scenes. Stupid. Cut that part about the action scenes as well. And I really like, who's the actress that plays? Is it Helen Hunt? No, Helen Hunt is totally different. Who does the voice of Elastigirl? I was close. Not Holly Hunt, but Holly Hunter. But yeah, Bonnie Hunt is who I'm thinking of, who's a different actress altogether. Anyway, so after some conflict over what to watch, I'm supposed to turn there. I'll turn on the next street.